loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we discuss the trilateral summit between Russia, Iran, and Turkey that took place in Tehran today. They were talking about what comes next with the city and province of Idlib in northern Syria. Although these three countries are the so-called guarantors of the peace process in Syria, they offered today vastly different, contradictory solutions. At the same time, the United States government may be poised to carry out a major military escalation, a major military attack on Syria, as the Russian government and Iran and Syria work together to clear Idlib of terrorist forces. This war could dramatically escalate, not end, in the coming days. We unpack this development and the press conference that followed the summit today in Iran. And then we take a look, as we do every Friday, at the political races around the country in the run-up to the midterm elections in November.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, this afternoon at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, President Obama delivered a speech that he called, quote, the state of our democracy, unquote. It was a clear beginning to his campaigning for Democrats during the midterm elections, and it focused on voter turnout. He also pushed back hard against President Trump, calling him a symptom of the country's problems, but not the disease. If Trump as president is a symptom, does Obama include himself as part of the disease? Next, Jair Bolsonaro, the far-right frontrunner in Brazil's presidential election, was stabbed in the stomach and seriously injured last night during a campaign rally. His assailant was caught. Bolsonaro has courted controversy throughout the campaign. Then, Senator Bernie Sanders announced a new bill yesterday called the Stop Bezos Act, which would require companies to pay for any vital social programs that their employees use because they're paid so little. This is after Amazon became the world's second company to be valued at over $1 trillion, despite paying its workers little and eliminating as many jobs as possible. While Amazon and Jeff Bezos earn more and more money, they actually eliminate people's jobs and lower basic incomes. And then Apple plans to create an online tool for police to formally request data about its users and to assemble a team to train police about what data can and cannot be obtained from the company. We'll look at what this means for privacy. And finally, it's Friday, so we'll look at the week's worst and most misleading headlines. And in other headlines, Judge Brett Kavanaugh underwent his fourth and final day of grilling today in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Over the course of the week, there were several protests, drama about secret documents being released, and tough questions on issues like abortion, gun control, and presidential authorities. But some analysts note that Kavanaugh's nomination is still likely to be approved. A Dallas, Texas police officer killed a man last night who she thought was in her apartment. But in fact, when she went home from work, she walked into the wrong apartment and shot the 26-year-old resident there. The victim's name was Botham Shem Jean, the son of a former permanent secretary of the Caribbean island of St. Lucia. President Trump said today that he has prepared tariffs against China on another $267 billion in goods, in addition to those he ordered some time ago on $200 billion of China's goods that haven't yet been put into effect. In the announcement today, he asked about when they might go into effect, and he said, quote, to a certain extent, it's going to be up to China, unquote. The president also announced today that he's willing to sit for an interview with special counsel Robert Mueller about the alleged collusion between his campaign and Russia in the 2016 elections, quote, under certain circumstances, unquote. Trump has repeatedly denied any collusion. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to Syria and the prospects for peace, or the prospects for an imminent battle prior to peace. The presidents of Russia, Iran, and Turkey met in Tehran today to discuss next steps in the Syrian province of Idlib, the Syrian rebels' last stronghold and home to thousands of terrorists. Russia and Iran have provided vital support to the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, but Turkey is fearful that a major assault on Idlib will result in a refugee crisis on its southern border, and perhaps worried about some other issues too. We're joined from the UK by Ambassador Peter Ford. He's the former British ambassador to Syria. And we're joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. Mark is an international affairs and security analyst. Peter, Mark, welcome back.
Thank you.
Brian, John, thanks for having us. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on Loud and Clear.
Thank you both for joining. A big day, Ambassador Ford. Russia, Iran, and Turkey are the guarantors, self-selected guarantors of the end of the war in Syria, the peace process, as per the Astana talks in Kazakhstan. What happened today?
I think it was a disappointment. There had been hopes that the three could agree on tackling together the terrorists in Idlib, separating the groups that are affiliated with Al-Qaeda or ISIS, separating them out from the slightly less radical groups, and liquidating them. And Turkey, it was hoped, would join in this operation rather than leave it to Russia and Syria and Iran. But it seems those hopes have been dashed. That Turkey, while it's willing to put its name to a statement that agrees in principle that these things should happen, is not actually prepared to exercise any military muscle against the terrorist groups. And I think that Turkey is just playing for time, waiting to see what comes of the promised U.S. bombing of Syria. Maybe, they think, they will be spared this dilemma.
Okay, Mark Sloboda, I'm going to play an audio clip from Turkish President Erdogan. But first, before we do that, I want you to also give us your big takeaway real quickly.
Yeah, I largely agree with Ambassador Ford that, you know, this is the sequence as it plays out. Turkey, Erdogan came to this meeting today loudly calling for a ceasefire and saying his hopes and that the future of the Astana agreement depended on an offensive to liberate Idlib not being launched. But quite remarkably, during the meeting, we saw the real attitudes of these three come to the public view for the first time, because broadcast today it was broadcast public. It wasn't behind closed doors, and we saw a back and forth between Rouhani and Putin on one side and Erdogan on the other. Where Rouhani said that, you know, there can be no peace in Idlib in Syria until all of the jihadists are eradicated, which is actually what the UN Security Council resolution calls for, multiple UN Security Council resolutions. And Erdogan, a short time later, replied that we can't leave Idlib in the hands, to the mercies of Assad, you know, the actual legitimate government of Syria, clearly, you know, staking his type of claim to it. And Putin, in dismissing a ceasefire, said, there are no representatives of Al-Qaeda or ISIS at this table. And I can imagine him looking quite pointedly at Erdogan when he was saying that. And that is the situation we face. That is why every ceasefire, every peace deal from Geneva to Kerry to the other destabilization zones has always failed, is because no one has succeeded in separating the good jihadis from the bad jihadis, because they're all the same. They fought amongst each other for rent and you know, for petty reasons, but when it comes down to, you know, the future of Syria, their vision under Islamic law, compared to the government, the multi-confessional, multi-ethnic secular republic in Syria, they're simply incompatible. And that's why you will never see Turkey succeed at this. I genuinely believe that Erdogan wanted Al-Qaeda, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, as they're branded now, to disband, right? To officially disband, and like Ahrar al-Sham and like al-Zinki, go dress up in proxy Turkish uniforms and continue to rule Idlib, just with more direct control rather than simply cooperation with Turkey. I believe that Turkey wanted to, Erdogan wants to extend Turkish control, not just over the Jarablus corridor, where he's already well entrenched and shows no sign of leaving with the military occupation, setting up a proxy government there, but he wanted to extend this to Idlib as well. And he obviously has never fought al-Qaeda. In fact, you know, the Western press, AP, Reuters, everyone reports that when he established his observation posts, as was required by the de-escalation agreement under the Astana process, that he did it not fighting his way past al-Qaeda and certainly not confronting them or trying to split them, but in cooperation with them. He got al-Qaeda escorts when he was setting up these observation posts. So Erdogan's role in this has always been quite cynical and quite duplicitous. I like to think of the Astana agreement as not, you know, one of friends or partners, but Putin and Erdogan waltzing across a chessboard with daggers poised at each other's back. Well, now comes the inevitable blowback. Erdogan bet on regime change. He failed. And from, you know, the U.S. backing the Kurds and having a Kurdish quasi-state in the east, now he faces the threat of jihadists fleeing Idlib along, you know, with the civilians, of course, adding to the refugee problem there, but into Turkey, where they will doubtless not be happy with Erdogan and his government for what they will inevitably having seen as betrayed. And so he faced the same terrorist threat being backlashed onto him that he's inflicted onto Syria for the last 7 years. So he's in a tough place.
That's the voice of Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We're talking to Mark from Moscow. We're also talking with Ambassador Peter Ford from London. Ambassador Ford is the former UK ambassador to Syria. We're going to play an audio clip now from today at this press conference following the talks between Iran, Russia, and Turkey. This is the voice of the translator for Russian President Erdogan. It's about a minute and 15 seconds long, but I want to play it, and then we're going to go to Peter Ford. I want you, Peter, if you might, to comment on Erdogan's presentation and also some of the points that Mark Sloboda was just making about Turkey's actual real intent. Let's listen to President Erdogan of Turkey.
Turkey has expressed its opinion that unless we contain the Syrian regime, this can lead to more tragedies, especially this concerns the possible offensive in Idlib, which can lead to mass destruction and also disrupt a possibility for a political settlement in Syria. We have established 12 observation missions in Syria, and we bear great responsibility for upkeeping peace and stability in the region, and therefore it is instrumental that we try to preserve peace in Idlib and avoid military action there, because we believe Idlib is essentially Syria in a nutshell, and any negative developments in that area will negatively affect all the stakeholders, and any action harming civilians in Idlib will only be to the benefit of terrorists. Since the beginning of the conflict in Syria, Turkey has done everything in its power to stop the bloodshed in Syria.
Remarkable, really.
It really is.
Turkey has done everything in its power to stop from the beginning the bloodshed in Syria. Anyway, Ambassador Ford, go ahead.
Erdogan's hypocrisy has no limits. Let's remember that the al-Qaeda-related groups only operate with the permission of Turkey. All their logistics come through Turkey and have come for the last several years, plus funding and intelligence support. They are Turkey's creatures, and it would be within the power of Turkey to put a leash on them, but they're obviously not prepared to do that. Perhaps with hindsight, we can say that Russia was a little bit naive, believing that Turkey ever would get tough with its puppets in Syria. There has been a pattern of that. After all, Russia naively believed that the United States, before the recovery of Aleppo, would winnow out the bad guys from the not-quite-so-bad guys. Pure wishful thinking. But I think the good thing to come out of this is that the way forward is clear. A military solution. Russia, Iran, and Syria now know where they stand. They can't rely whatever on Turkey. Turkey probably will not react. Turkey's going through the motions at the moment, but Turkey, I don't think, will actually lift a military finger to prevent the eradication by others of their puppets.
I'd like to know, too, what kind of a timetable we're talking about here, because although everybody's willing to meet and everybody's willing to meet at a very high level, chief of state level, they're all very far apart about what is going to happen to the foreign fighters, to the terrorist groups. They can't go north. They can't go south. They can't go west. And there's nothing east, at least there's nothing for them east other than the Americans preparing to bomb them there. So how are we going to get through this impasse as to what to do with foreign fighters? Mark?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't exactly agree that there's nowhere for them to go, because they've been operating out of Turkey. I mean, that's been their, you know, the home base, you know, where they've been trained up and gotten their salaries and so on. So certainly some of them will try to go back there. Maybe Turkey will try to keep them from coming, but that will be difficult. And they can certainly go to the northeast, and that is actually where Turkey would like a great deal of them to go, into the Jarablus Corridor, this area that's militarily occupied by Turkey, and that, you know, they would then presumably shave off their beards and don new Syrian army Turkish proxy uniforms. And that's I think what Erdogan would like most here. You know, I agree, but he doesn't want open conflict with them, and I can't see him engaging with them, nor can I see him engaging in conflict with the Russian military. He is very much in fear, considering the state of the Turkish economy now, a return of Russian economic sanctions on Turkey. You know, that would be just a nail in the coffin. But there is places for them to flee to. Whether they will or not, they're pretty well entrenched there, and they may have already feel that this is their last stronghold. Others may try to flee into be willing to don the Turkish proxy uniforms and go there. I'm not so sure that that Putin has been entirely naive this whole time, as he's always continued to push forward. You know, what I agree is the only end solution. You can't have a political solution with al-Qaeda. You can't have a political solution with Ahrar al-Sham or the Turkestan Islamic Party or al-Zinki. It's simply incompatible with a secular, multi-confessional, multi-ethnic Syrian republic. I think that Putin has somewhat, maybe skillfully, simply played for time in dealing in one enemy at a time, and he's made excellent use of circumstances to affect the split between Saudi Arabia and Qatar there, which has certainly decreased their funding involvement for what's going on. He has skillfully worked these ruptures over the support of the Kurds with Turkey and the United States. You know, they're very much estranged now, Turkey and the EU. And now Erdogan is in a very bad place with the U.S., and he can't afford, even open proxy conflict with Russia and Iran at this point. Although we're starting to see some shift. And just this morning, The Guardian actually reported that there is a unit of Kurds that at least were formerly backed by the U.S., the Syrian Democratic Forces, a small unit, that has agreed to fight with the Syrian government to liberate Idlib. And this is marking this shift where the U.S. has made concessions to the Turks. They've surrendered the Manbij and so on. And the Kurds are starting to realize that their only hope for retaining even a degree of the autonomy that they've achieved over these last years is with the government in Damascus and, you know, Russia acting as interlocutors. So we might start to see a shift where Turkey now pivots more closer to the U.S. position, especially with this new announcement that the U.S. intends an indefinite military presence in Syria. They never intend to leave Syria until they can drive all Iranian forces out of the country, as if the U.S. has the right to decide who the Syrian government can and can't ally with, until they get a government that the international community can approve of, and of course until ISIS is defeated, which they are literally sheltering the last pockets of up against the Iraqi border and haven't taken any significant military action against for nearly a year.
Ambassador Ford, can you see these foreign fighters and terrorist groups fighting to the death? Is this the end of it for them? Or do you see them running to Turkey or elsewhere?
As Mark said, they can melt back into Turkey, or they can be rebadged as pro-Turkish militia. After all, this is just days ago, Turkey was making this offer to them. They said, if you disband officially and join our wonderful militia, you can go. This is obviously the fallback solution for the foreign fighters. They're by no means backs to the wall, though I do expect them to put up a fierce resistance. But while all this is going on, Uncle Sam is poised to come down with a big hammer. These threats of the last several days clearly flag an intention to bomb Syria on the pretext of a fake chemical incident. And I greatly fear that the bombing is going to be much heavier than last time. This could alter everybody's calculations, military and political.
Yeah, and if that were to happen, all of the critics of Donald Trump, the neocon critics who are inside the Trump administration who did the op-ed, the neocon critics of Trump who are in the Democratic Party leadership, and that would be almost all of them now, the neocon political leadership who are in the Republican Party, that would be about the entire Republican Party. The neocons or the neocon ideology was a thing part of the Republican Party back in 2001. Now it is the consensus position. And if that were to happen, Donald Trump would start to have a lot of kudos shouted out to him for acting presidential. It would be perfect, actually, for Trump to change the subject and to mute the criticism. So I agree with Ambassador Ford that the danger here is actually real of a larger American military attack. We're not trying to be hyperbolic, but I don't think we need to be hyperbolic to at least identify that as a variant.
And just this morning, Secretary Mattis said that we're in there until the bitter end, that there will be no withdrawal of U.S. troops.
No, and it's God gave America the right to do this. Of course, that's because it's America. It's an exceptional country. But before we go back to both of you, I want to play another in our final audio clip. It's President Rouhani, the president of Iran, talking today. And then let's come back and sort of put his comments into the context of, or do we anticipate a larger U.S. military presence? And we'll throw it back to you, Mark. But first, let's hear President Rouhani.
After Idlib, the next important issue is liberating Eastern Euphrates. Mainly, it has American military presence there, and their illegal activities unfortunately have enabled large forces of militants to accumulate there. We must ensure that all foreign troops leave this region, and next step would be establishing a constitutional committee in Syria.
Okay, Mark Sloboda, that was President Rouhani. Clear the Americans from the northeastern part of Syria. Let's talk about that and also your own view about, as Ambassador Ford has opened the door to this discussion, will the Americans now have a pretext to come in a massive or larger, at least, military presence, perhaps rearranging the whole deck there? Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is a real possibility now, and it is a real danger with you know, the announcements we've seen in the past 24 hours, the comments that we saw from David Ignatius interviewing an anonymous administration official in the Washington Post last week, when they said, the administration official said, the job of the U.S. is to create as many quagmires for the Syrian government and for Russia as they can now in Syria until we get what we want. Well, we know what they want. And for the U.S., this has always largely been about Iran, you know, at least from a geopolitical angle. You know, the U.S. Neocons, the geopoliticians, talked endlessly about what they perceived as an arc of Shiite influence that was created by their disastrous invasion of Iraq, which brought the Iraqi government much closer to Iran. So, ending this Shia arc to the Mediterranean was, you know, the reason that they started this whole pursuit of regime change against Syria. And again, you know, they're facing the backlash that the only reason Iran is really in Syria to the extent that they are is because they've been waging a proxy war to overthrow the government here. So they've created more of a mess, and they're just, you know, feeding their own military involvement at this point. But I think with reports we've seen out of Washington, with this anonymous deep stater outing himself, I am the voice of the resistance, and Bob Woodward's book, we've seen more than ever that Trump really isn't in control of his own foreign and military policy. And the deep state, the announcements show, is in more firm control than ever before.
Mark, it's not the deep state, it's the steady state. You need to read the op-ed.
Yeah, they prefer that branding, I understand. But, Trump may very well have been convinced that an excellent way of riding into the midterms is with a renewed military conflict looking presidential in Syria.
Yep. I think if you think about it, if Mattis and the Pentagon are willing to go along, because of course they would have to, they have their own calculations, and I don't think they're going to be completely subordinate to Trump or to anybody. They certainly weren't subordinate to Obama or to John Kerry after the last ceasefire agreement that was made right before the 2016 election. They sabotaged that. But Ambassador Ford, you've been saying the last couple days, last couple weeks, hey, all earlier calculations might be overturned. We might be heading into really, really new and very dangerous territory with, at the very moment that it seemed like the war could end finally for Syria and Syrians, that the war could be, in fact, about to expand.
Yeah, well, the U.S. Permanent government, if they don't like the term deep state, the permanent government that's now coming out into the open is now in the last chance saloon on Syria. Most of Syria has now been pacified. Idlib is virtually the last chance for them to turn the tables. And it's gotten down to the last few days, because within days I expect the Russian-Syrian campaign to become much heavier, and they will proceed quickly. So the jihadis who are planning the fake attack have to move quickly. Within days, I would guess, in order to bring on this powerful U.S. retribution, which I think will be aimed at decapitating the Syrian state.
Yeah, those are the reports, that the targeting is actually against the Syrian government itself. Take out Assad, take out the Syrian leadership. Anyway, we will see. This is going to be an important next few days. Everybody should be on, if you're here in the United States or in the UK, on an anti-war alert, because we could be just coming right up to the precipice. Anyway, we're out of time. We were joined from UK by Ambassador Peter Ford. Peter is the former British ambassador to Syria. And we were joined once again from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. Mark is an international affairs and security analyst. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host, Brian Becker. It's Friday, so again, today we take a look at political races around the country in the run-up to midterm elections in November. We're joined here in the studio by Jacqueline and Abdus Lukman. They're the co-editors-in-chief of Lukman Nation, and you can check out their live stream every Thursday night at 9 p.m. on Facebook. Welcome back, both of you.
Thanks so much.
Good to have you. I want to start with Massachusetts. Ayanna Pressley defeated a 10-term incumbent in Mike Capuano in the Democratic primary there on Tuesday. The reason I want to start with this is there was nothing wrong with Mike Capuano. He was a mainstream Hillary Clinton Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
10 terms. He's been in the House of Representatives for 20 years. But Ayanna Pressley is not a nobody. Ayanna Pressley is a seasoned politician herself. She's a member of the Boston City Council. And she crushed this guy. What do you make of this race? And what does it mean for other progressive versus moderate Democrats in their primaries around the country?
I think the key behind Pressley's win is that she wanted to be the face of a changing district, right? The district that Capuano represented became majority minority, meaning that most of the people in the district became minority residents. So that the demographics changed in that district. And even though the moderate Democrat policies were okay, at some point voters really felt like Capuano didn't represent them, that he was out of touch. He couldn't relate to them. And they felt like Ayanna Pressley could relate better to them, that she was more of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked
mm-hmm.
about that from Netroots, from right. with the mayor of Jackson saying that this needs to be the mandate for Democrats now, for the Democratic Party, that voters need to send our representatives to the establishment rather than the establishment telling us who we should decide on.
And that's what happened in Queens and
yeah.
the Bronx when we mm-hmm. talked about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez
yes.
Defeating another incumbent, a long-term incumbent, in the New York congressional primary. Abdus, do you think that there's a certain anger behind these votes among Democrats? Now, the race itself, the Capuano-Pressley race, was not a negative race. Neither one of them went negative on each other. But do you think that there's an anger among voters that these longtime mainstream Democrats are just too willing to go along to get along and that we need to shake the thing up?
Well, yeah, I think so. But I want to go back and saying that with the Ayanna Pressley win, this wasn't just a win. She beat him. I mean, it was like, 10 percentage points or more? So she beat him. So that was a very loud message from the people that they wanted change. And then we're talking about Boston. We're talking about that this was actually indicative of the demographic changes, which is happening in Boston. I think the same way in Ocasio's territory, too. But it's also, John, to answer your point directly, yes, I think it is anger from the base who is tired of establishment politics. I mean, let's look at it. Ocasio and Pressley both unseated, well-entrenched incumbents. And I don't know if this may be the end of the anchored, seasoned white male politician. I'm not sure, but there's definitely changes on the horizon here.
I agree. I think that something is going on that I think most observers underestimated, and it's going to become a movement.
Mm-hmm.
I really believe that.
Yeah.
We haven't seen it yet in the Senate. And I say that because in Delaware this week, Senator Tom Carpenter handily held off a challenger in the primary from the left, and he won about 63% of the vote.
Mm-hmm.
But Delaware's a different place than Massachusetts.
Right.
And so I think we probably should not have expected a successful challenge against Carper in Delaware.
Yeah, I mean, because Delaware honestly hasn't seen the demographics changes that a place like Boston has and that a place like New York has, that Queens had seen. There isn't an influx of new Hispanic voters. Right. The demographics shift between black and white voters hasn't changed much. The class demographics, the economic demographics hasn't changed much. And you have to remember how small Delaware really is.
It is.
So
there are three counties.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, unless more than half the population moves out of Delaware, or you get an influx of at least 40% of new people into Delaware, and there is no reason for that many people to actually move to Delaware.
No.
You're not going to see a whole lot of political change in that
state. You know, there are states where that kind of thing actually is happening. We're seeing huge influxes of Latinos into North Carolina and Oregon, and they are actually changing the political demographic of those states.
Right.
It's happening slowly, but it's happening.
Yes.
And that's why these gerrymandered district boundaries in North Carolina are going to have to be changed.
Absolutely.
Well, let's move over to Chicago. Abdus, let's turn to you. Rahm Emanuel this week shocked everybody by saying that he was not going to run for re-election as mayor of Chicago. You can look at this two different ways. Number one, he's been a terrible mayor. Violence is worse than it's ever been in the history of the city. And he's a failure, and he's going to go make multimillion dollars a year as an attorney someplace.
Right.
Or he's going to run for president. Why do you think he's leaving the position of mayor of Chicago?
My answer is your first point, that he's been a horrible mayor.
Terrible.
The thing of it is that this Laquan McDonald case, where the officer, I believe, now is on trial, that has really overshadowed a lot this his administration. The fact that he has never really developed a very good relationship with the black community there. And the fact
from the
that
beginning,
from the
he
beginning,
hasn't.
No, he hasn't. And the fact that the school systems, everything, just been a disaster for this guy here. I feel that he understood. It didn't surprise me, but I think he understood that he didn't have a chance in winning.
Right.
I think that the opposition to him was just so great that he didn't have a chance. Now, the thing of it is that when it comes to his aspirations for president, he may have that, but with the trends that we're seeing now, with the Democrats of the recent Democratic wins, I don't think there's room for Rahm Emanuel. I don't. I think that his type, that ilk, that type, his type of that type of politician, I think that the Democratic electorate will not embrace.
Yeah.
Well, let me read something from the Washington Post that I think just confirms everything you just said. It says here, criticism has been mounting over Emanuel's handling of unrelenting gun violence, police misconduct, and an economic strategy that some say favors the rich. Weekend surges in shooting victims this summer had sparked yet another wave of public protests among the people in this city who are affected the most, residents of the South and West Sides, areas that represent, and this is important, at least two-thirds of the city and are populated by a majority of blacks and Hispanics. There are a dozen people running in the mayoral primary right now. It's probably going to double now that he's out. But I think you're right. I think he didn't have a chance.
No. And he knew he didn't have a chance.
Yeah.
You know, I'll tell you something, too. I know Rahm Emanuel. We were both interns together at the United Food and Commercial Workers Union back in the 1980s.
Oh, interesting.
When I was a freshman and he was a senior. And he was so aggressive, so arrogant back then that as a 22-year-old, he used to talk about running for president.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that just confirms our suspicions. When I say our, I mean the voters' suspicions that these people who end up being our so-called choices for who we should vote for, I mean, they're not genuinely organically grown from among the people. They're chosen. They're chosen and they're groomed. So they're kind of foisted upon us.
They are.
And we don't really have a choice. Like somebody like you just said, Rahm Emanuel, who at 22 is a senior in college and he's already exhibiting the characteristics that the party is looking for, that the machine is looking for.
That's
but
exactly
the kind
what it was.
Of person they want to push into politics. And they see that and they snatch that person up and they groom him and they put this person, male or female, into these programs and put them, you know, in front of these groups of people and get them doing. And that's how the Rahm Emanuels and honestly the Barack Obamas and the George W. Bushes, that's how they get to be our choices for president.
Well, yeah, but let's also, because when you mentioned about his arrogance, let's look at this. Here you have a guy who leaves the Obama White House, right?
Mm-hmm.
Chief of staff. He leaves the Obama White House. And then he just decides, well, I'm going to be mayor of one of America's largest cities.
Right.
You know, and so.
And it was a coronation. It wasn't even much of an election.
Yes. No, it wasn't. And then here he gets out there. And I mean, cities are very complicated things, you know, especially a city like Chicago and the Chicago politics and the political machine, which is pretty unique in the country as opposed to everywhere else. Mm-hmm. And here you got a guy, leaves the Obama White House, goes out there with the arrogance that he is going to save, you know, Chicago, and he just makes a bigger mess of it. But in my view, I feel that it was more not so much about Chicago or the love of Chicago or saving Chicago as it was for a political stepping point to other aspirations that he might have had.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the obscene thing, though, especially for the Democratic Party, that if a Democrat wants to use a city like Chicago or to be the mayor of any city as a stepping stone to the presidency, then enact some policies that will help those people in
exactly.
that city
right.
so that they
right.
can get
exactly.
behind you and right. say, see, look at what he did for us.
And it's not like this violence is anything new.
Right.
It's not like police corruption is anything new. He
right.
had years
yeah.
to work on this. He left the
That's
White
right.
House when? In 2010.
I think mm-hmm. it was 10, 2010.
Okay, so he's had 8 years to mm-hmm. make this right.
Right.
And he's done nothing.
No.
Yeah, and it's not as if in the world of politics and social science and honestly just common sense, it's not as if this is rocket science.
No.
That we don't know what
or
brings.
That other mayors haven't confronted these same problems.
Exactly. Oh, right. It's good paying jobs. It's quality public school education. It's access to health care so people don't have to worry about getting sick and not being able to work. It's quality, affordable housing. It's all of those things. It's holding law enforcement accountable when they mistreat the population they're supposed to serve. It's those five things. It's that simple.
Well, you talk about mistreating the population. I'll just make this quick. Is the fact that one of the things that I will never forget or forgive him for. First of all, as a Democrat, as a politician under the Democratic flag,
mm-hmm.
the Democratic Party flag, it's one thing to ignore black people as, you know, black people being one of the being the most loyal
constituency.
Yeah, constituency yeah. to the Democratic Party. It's one thing to ignore them. It's one thing to totally mistreat them.
Yeah.
And I'm never going to forget when they had a town hall meeting in South Side of Chicago.
Yes.
To talk about some of the issues that the black community was very concerned about.
Mm-hmm.
And they invited Rahm Emanuel and he didn't even show up.
Right. And I think that was the town hall where they wanted to talk about his mass closing of public
of
schools.
Public
right.
schools,
which
right.
has been a disaster in
yeah.
Chicago.
Yes.
Yeah. So good, you know, good for Chicago and the residents of Chicago. Good riddance to Rahm Emanuel. Be real careful.
Yeah.
Who you choose for the next person.
I want to switch now over to my favorite politician in America, and that's Beto O'Rourke.
Yeah.
This guy, how he's doing this in Texas against Ted Cruz is a mystery to me. The latest poll has Beto O'Rourke behind by 1 percentage point, which is well within the margin of error.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
He has doggedly visited every single county in the entire state of Texas. Now, it's not that there's any Democratic wave in Texas. Governor Abbott's running for re-election, and he's polling 17 percentage points ahead of his Democratic competitor.
Right. Right.
I think it's in part that Beto O'Rourke is a really great politician. He's sincere. He speaks Spanish, which is important in
right.
Texas.
Right.
And he's got nothing to lose. So he's just speaking his mind.
Mm-hmm.
And he's honest about what he stands for. You know, there's this video on Facebook that's been making the rounds at a recent town hall meeting in a very heavily Republican part of Texas where somebody asked him about Colin Kaepernick and kneeling for the national anthem.
Right.
And he was honest.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he supports it.
Right.
Because it's not about disrespect for the flag or for the country. It's a protest against police violence.
Right.
And that's what you have to remember. He didn't shy away from that.
That's right.
He didn't play to his audience.
Mm-hmm.
He was honest.
Exactly.
Now, it also might be that Ted Cruz is a lousy campaigner, which we already knew.
Mm-hmm.
He's not the best looking guy to look at.
Not at all.
Teddy Munster.
Yeah, exactly. He's very stiff.
Yeah.
He's just not a very good politician.
Mm-hmm.
What was really interesting to me, interesting in a ha-ha funny kind of way, is that Donald Trump went to Texas to campaign for Ted Cruz this week. Well, they hate each other. And indeed, the president accused Trump's father of killing Kennedy.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my gosh.
So, I mean, it's just an insincere political gesture. And yeah. I think really that Cruz is on his own in this race.
Yeah.
It's his to lose.
He, you know what? He might lose it. He really might lose
it. It's all about turnout.
It is absolutely all about turnout. There was a poll, and I am not one to pay too much attention to polls. I just normally don't. But there is an interesting poll that was done by a polling company that presented its results to Telemundo, the Mason-Dixon polling.
And Mason-Dixon's quite good.
Yeah, they have Beto O'Rourke winning among Hispanic voters.
Yes, for the first time in this campaign.
Wow. By double digits, like by 20 percentage points.
And in the last poll, he was losing Hispanics.
Yes. But again, John, the key is voter turnout.
It is.
And I don't think that's going to be a problem. I don't think that's going to be a problem in this
race.
And
I really don't think it's going to be a problem, especially with what just happened with the thing with the separation of the families at the border and all that chaos they took down there. Hispanics really want to make a point here. Mm-hmm. You know, and going back, John, to what you were saying about the type of campaigner that O'Rourke is. I mean, I saw that video and I got to say, I mean, this guy has charisma.
He does.
Yeah.
I mean, he has charisma. I mean, I watched this video and I'm in my mind trying to figure out, wow, how would Cruz answer that? Well, I know how he would answer it, you know, but this guy, O'Rourke, has charisma. I think that, and it reminds me of the Kennedy-Nixon debate.
Oh,
when
the
whole thing when they were on TV, and you had the good-looking Kennedy, and you had the sweating, stiff-looking Nixon. That to me, that's reminiscent of that whole thing.
You know, another thing, too, that was just so entertaining to me this week in that race is the Republicans came out with an ad. It was supposed to be an attack ad.
Mm-hmm.
And it showed Beto O'Rourke with his shirt off. This is from the 1990s. Wow. He has his shirt off and he's playing bass in a band.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the reaction was, oh my God, he's so cool. He
right.
was in a band.
Right, right, right.
Like, I knew I liked him, but I didn't know that I could like him this much. He's so cool.
Right, it totally backfired, and the Cruz people had to pull the ad off television because it was helping O'Rourke.
Yes.
Oh my God.
It's really bad. The Texas GOP, they even tweeted an image of O'Rourke in his band where one of his bandmates had on a dress. And they tried to make a big deal about that with the caption under the picture that said, "Can't debate Cruz going to a gig." Well, nobody took offense to that.
No.
No,
People thought it was cool.
Yep.
The Cruz campaign and the Texas GOP are desperate. They are sweating, and they should be, because they very well could lose.
And they just don't know how to confront this guy, because they never thought that they would lose.
Exactly.
Right.
And so here he is. Here O'Rourke is running all over the state to every county, no matter how few Democrats are in these counties.
Mm-hmm.
He does town hall meetings in every single one of them.
Yep.
Right.
There are counties, many counties in Texas that Ted Cruz has never been to.
Yeah.
He never had to go to them.
And that might be the key.
That might be it.
The backbreaker.
You know, I remember
right there.
When I was a kid, there was a Democratic insurgent that ran for Congress in our district. And one of the reasons why he won was that he put these little tags on people's doors. He was going door to door and he said, "Hi, my name is Joe Blow. I'm running for Congress and I care enough about your vote to come and ask you for it."
Wow.
Mm.
And that worked. People like to meet the candidate. People want to know that they can be comfortable with the candidate or they can trust the candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And O'Rourke is succeeding that.
But aren't we seeing that working now with Ocasio's win?
And Presley's win.
Seeing,
and,
right, right. So we're still seeing that same get out there, pressing flesh, meeting people is still has an effect on the populace, you know?
Yeah. Hey, let's talk about Florida. There are two important things that are playing out in Florida right now. One is, according to Politico, there's a new poll that came out this week in the Senate race between Governor Rick Scott and Senator Bill Nelson. It's 49-49.
Wow.
With only 2% undecided. That is unbelievable this far out from the election. And this is a Quinnipiac poll. It's my experience that Quinnipiac is probably the best polling outfit in America. 49-49. They're saying that this is going to be the most expensive Senate race in American history. So far, the Democrats have spent $55.5 million just on television ads. The Republicans have spent $66.5 million just on television ads. And they're talking about this race costing as much as $500 million for a job that pays $200,000 a year.
Oh, wow.
What do you make of this?
First of all, just the numbers, just the amount of money that political parties put into, that they're willing to put into electing people to public office. And these are people who decide how the state spends its money on its people, is obscene. $500 million can underwrite the public school education
Imagine.
In the entire state.
Imagine the good works you can do with $500 million.
Obscene. But the fact that this far out, like you said, John, from the election, Nelson is neck and neck.
He's going to lose.
That tells me he's going to lose.
Because if you've been in this office for 18 years and you can't get a majority of your voters to support you,
they want you gone.
You're going
to
lose.
They want you gone. This to me, unless some bizarre miracle happens, and stranger things have happened in politics, but this to me is a death knell.
Yeah, I think
For Nelson's career.
I think so too. One of the interesting things that this poll found is that the entire state is polarized. It's polarized by party affiliation, by gender, by race, and by ethnicity.
Right.
It's one of the most, if not the most, polarized state in America right now, Florida. And Florida's as purple as it comes. Now, the other interesting thing in Florida is the gubernatorial race. Let's talk about Gillum for a minute. You know, this is a guy that wasn't supposed to win the Democratic primary, and he won pretty handily.
Right.
The Republicans have been beating him about the face and head since the election. He's taken it. He doesn't seem to be hurting in the polls.
Right.
And he's come out and he's made a couple of controversial policy stands, specifically as it relates to BDS.
Yes.
Yeah.
So with all the Jewish voters in Florida, was this a smart political decision?
Well, I put it this way. The way that our politics are in this country, because Jackie, you and I spoke about this morning, and I think that his hands were basically tied. You really can't, realistically speaking, you really can't be in American politics and take this stance of being BDS.
Right.
Jackie and I always say that as an American politician, you have to kiss the ring.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, and unfortunately, that's the way our politics have.
And AIPAC is the ring. They're just the ring.
I mean,
especially in Florida.
Yes.
Right. And you know, without trying to sound too offensive, I would just say that, you know, the foreign interests that we have in our politics, and especially Jewish lobbyists' influences in our politics, even when you want to, as Andrew Gillum, want to be on the right side of some of these things. I think that the way that it's too much to ask. I mean, he hasn't won, so we don't know what he's going to do once he get in there. But I think to play the political game, I think it was the right move right now.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the unfortunate thing is that politically, it was the right move because he couldn't have said anything else if he wants to not have to deal with that coming from a Republican challenger, because they would absolutely use this, you know.
Well, like, they make it all about that.
Exactly. And politically, he couldn't take that risk. Ideologically, just coming from the perspective of a black man who is running for public office in a country that's just, what, barely 100 years out of Jim Crow, saying that you support, you are against a movement that opposes apartheid, which is basically what's going on in Israel.
Yeah.
That's really ideologically problematic. But unfortunately, in politics in this country, our politics is so immature when it comes to foreign policy. This is one of those lesser evil things where it's like, what do you do?
I have to agree.
And another point I wanted to make about Gillum, too, is the fact that here he is, someone who is part of what we always say as the Bernie Sanders faction of the Democrat Party, you know. And we've seen how even the mainstream press has been treating him.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, you know, they were hostile to Bernie Sanders when Bernie Sanders was running. And so the fact that he is where he is now, And I think that he has done a great job, even with the hostility that I've seen that he received at the hands of what I call corporate media. Also, that wasn't, you know, that really doesn't want a true progressive candidate. You know, the corporate media is all about supporting the status quo. And you know, so I just thought that was interesting.
In Arizona, Governor Ducey this week named John Kyle, the former senator, to replace John McCain. Mm-hmm. Kyle is only going to serve until January, mm-hmm. and there's going to be a special election. I think Kyle, if you're a Republican, Kyle's probably the best choice because he knows what he's doing. He's been a senator. He's a mainstream Republican. Mm-hmm. He's only going to be there for a few months, mm-hmm. and then there's going to be this election. Mm-hmm. It's the other Senate race that's the real question mark. You know, we've talked about the fact that Arizona is going to have female senator for the first time in its history, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, she's going to be a senator. Mm-hmm. But the ideologies in that race couldn't be further apart. So if, and I'm looking at a poll on Politico, they went through the country and they're predicting every House race, every Senate race, and every gubernatorial race. And they have, well, let me call it up here. For governor, they have Ducey probably winning re-election. In the Arizona Senate race, they call it a toss-up, which means it's essentially tied.
Right, right.
And all it says here is one of the few Democratic pickup opportunities this cycle, Arizona has been moving toward the party over the past decade. So you think we could see a split vote where the Republicans win the governor's race and the Democrats win the Senate?
Yes. I think that's entirely possible, especially with this appointment of Kyle. Let's be honest. He's just the seat filler to vote Kavanaugh. That's really what he's there. And
that's
he understands that's what mm-hmm. his role is. He might throw his hat in the ring afterward, might not, but he knows that right now that's his job to get Kavanaugh confirmed. Down the road in the primaries to come, I think Arizona is gonna be split between the House and the Senate, and it's gonna continue to be pretty much exactly as it is.
We have only about a minute left, so I'm gonna just go to the House of Representatives here. Washington Post ABC News poll that came out this week shows that blue wave that's coming. Mm. You could even call it a tsunami because among all registered voters in the generic, who would you vote for Congress, a Democrat or a Republican? 52% Democrat, 38% Republican, 10% undecided, and the rest for smaller parties. They're talking about a Democratic pickup of between 22 and 36 seats. Democrats need 24 to win back the House.
Right.
It looks like it's going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Take us out. Our last 30 seconds, Jackie.
You know what? The blue wave might win Democrat seats. But again, we keep saying every week, what does that mean for actual policies for the people? If these are not, if these seats don't represent progressive policies, the people still don't win. All we get is we don't have Trump Republicans in the House.
Agreed. I don't think very much is going to change at all. Well, we were joined here in the studio by both Jackie and Abdus Lukman. They're the co-editors-in-chief of Lukman Nation, and you can check out their live stream every Thursday night at 9 p.m. on Facebook. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.